Thank you very much. I'm going to use you as an example because it's quite clear that with all these terrible things that people say about the bureaucracy, after all, you work in one bureaucracy, Bill Niskanen works in another, and it's clear that on these issues that we're talking about, it isn't because of your lack of character, I'm sure, that we suffer from the problems that we're going to talk about. What I'm going to talk about is a general outline of some work that my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon, Scott Richard, and I have been doing for longer than we should have. That is, it's taken us a while to try to straighten out our own ideas, and we have wandered through some of the many issues that people here have talked about today. And what I'd like to say is, what I'd like to do in my talk today is to give some idea of the general approach that we've taken, some of the facts that we have developed, and what we think, why we think the general problem arises. And I'm very pleased that Bill Reckenbacher is going to give the answers, because the one thing that I have learned from working in this area is that answers are not easy to come by. So I'll be very attentive to what he has to tell you. The first point that I would like to make is that this issue is often discussed as a moral rather than a cognitive issue. The problem, as we see it, is a cognitive issue. That is, we don't believe that there's anything that I can say that is any better put, well, more likely to convince people, whether you or people who are less convinced about the need for a smaller government, that I can say anything that has not been said before and has perhaps not been said at least as well, perhaps much better than anything that I can say. That is, it is not through the power or lack of persuasion that we see the government grow. Nor do I believe that it is the result of the other major belief that there has been somehow a shift in the moral composition of the fiber of the American or other people that has led them to believe now that they should do things which increase the size of the government. Rather, I believe the opposite, that what we observe is not a recent phenomenon, something that occurred because the New Deal or the Fair Deal or the Great Society was suddenly foisted upon us, but rather quite the opposite, that what we observe is the result of our own actions as voters going to the polling place, that each of us is endowed with a certain amount of property, including our own human abilities, and one man, one vote, or something very much like that. And what we observe is the outcome, or we believe is the outcome of a process in which some people have different properties or different opportunities to earn income, and everybody has the same opportunity to vote. One way of stating that question is to reverse the usual order. It is usual in discussions of this kind to think about the problem by asking, why is it that we have deteriorated into our present position? I think a much, much more fruitful line of inquiry is to ask, why is it that Smith, or whoever it was that was the founding genius of the change from British mercantilism and European mercantilism to a free market economy, why was it that they succeeded? What was it that was present at that time that is not present now? That question came up this morning, and I think it's an important question, because as you'll see, I think that a crucial difference between what was true then and what is true now is that people were not equally endowed with votes at the time of Adam Smith, but indeed it was not that there were all those things about the so-called rotten boroughs, the number of people who could vote, there were property restrictions on voting, there were other features that were common then that are not common now. And as the spread of the system of one man, one vote has come along, we find that there is greater growth of government. The third main point that I want to make in introducing this problem, or introducing my remarks on this problem, is to say that basically we can strip the problem down into two very distinct processes. One is the problem of redistribution. And when we want to think about the government, we want to think about redistribution. Not always redistribution from the rich to the poor, but redistribution across the spectrum of votes to those people who have the most votes. The process, the political process, is basically a process by which individuals gain through the ballot box what they sometimes are unable to gain through the market process. And that these two processes, that we should expect them to behave in the ballot box in much the same way that we expect them to behave in the marketplace. That is, to behave rationally, to think, what is in my interest and what can I gain by voting the way that I do? And some people describe that as a process of vote selling. But I don't believe that people are being bought into the positions that they are taking, that they are putting themselves into the positions. That is, the position of saying, what is it that I can gain through the ballot box that I have not been able yet or do not expect to be able to get through the market process? Those are the basic notions with which I start, or from which we start, and I would like to give, in order to give some idea about what those notions bring me to, they help to discriminate between some very broad classes of hypotheses. For example, if we look at some of the facts that have, that we have developed and which we are in the process of publishing, we tried to compute to use two measures of the growth of government. Now, the subject of the growth of government is a difficult one, and I'll only say a few words. Ideally, when we want to measure the government, we want to measure something like the amount of distortions, broadly conceived, that the government imposes on us, minus the distortions that the government removes. And we'd like to measure that net burden of the government. And somehow those distortions include, of course, the loss of freedom that we believe is to be negatively, that we mostly believe to be negatively correlated with the growth of government and the share of taxes and so on, and with the size of the bureaucracy. Well, measurement of these net distortions, and certainly measurement in across various countries and over time, is not an easy task. And so we have contented ourselves to take a very quick look at the problem by saying, let's take two very broad measures of the growth of government. One is the number of people, the proportion of the population that works for the government, believing that that is somehow correlated with the number of regulators and presumably with the number of regulations over time. And second, the share of taxes or the share of income taken by the government in taxes. And we've looked at those two measures across those sub-periods and periods for which we could get some information. And by and large, they tell the same story. We have measures of the growth of government in the United States, very rough measures from 1792 on, constructed as follows. We took the growth rate of taxes, which is a simple measure and one for which, for the federal government, one for which data is readily available, and we figured out what the compound rate of growth of real tax payments to the government has been over the period 1792 to 1974. It turned out, after allowance for an equally crude measure of inflation over that period, that the growth of taxes is 5.5% per year compounded annually. We then asked, what would private per capita income have to have been in 1792 in order for private per capita income to have grown at the rate 5.5% compounded annually for that 190-year period? And the answer is, per capita income in 1792 would have had to have been $20. Right? $20 of 1974 purchasing power. Now, since we know that per capita income, whatever it was at the time that the Constitution was put into operation, was larger than $20, we know that over the whole period, the government has grown, on average, faster than the private sector. That tells us something about what the nature of the problem is, because it immediately discards, if it's correct, it discards theories which say that this is a recent phenomenon arising because of the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the Great Society, the Income Tax Amendment, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, and all the other variety of special things that have occurred. Now, in order to check that, we looked at what had happened in the 20th century, and we found that for the 20th century, when we can get both ends of the data that we're looking for, that is both taxes paid to the federal government and taxes paid to state and local government, those are separate measures, and we can also get income, so we can thereby compute the share of government and how it's grown over that period, we found that it in fact is lower, if anything, than the share of growth of government that we have for the whole period, suggesting that the growth of government in the 19th century was, on average, no smaller than the growth of government during the 20th century. A second measure which we tried to use, which is entirely independent of the first, was to compute the greater growth of employment in the federal government during this period. And we have a number growing back to 1821, and we computed the growth of government employment from 1821 to 1901, and we got a number which is 4.5%, which coincides rather well with the number that we had before. And we again find that for the same period, on comparable basis, the growth of government employment has been slower in the 20th century than it was in the period of the 19th century for which we have measures. And without going into all the details of these measures, let me just say that for each period that we have looked at, we get roughly comparable numbers from looking, especially in the 20th century, whether we use the tax share, whether we use the labor market share, we get roughly comparable measures. And they tell us that over any reasonable sub-period, that is, if you don't start at the peak of a war and compute down, we find that the government has been growing about twice the speed with which the private sector has been growing, somewhere between 1.75 and 2.5 times as fast during the various sub-periods, that there was some acceleration during the New Deal and the Fair Deal of the federal government, but over the whole period, one is safe by saying that this is not a recent phenomenon. It's a phenomenon that has been going on for a long time, and it represents at least a first cut at the problem about why the process goes on. There has not been a recent change in taste, but there may have been, and there has been, a recent meaning that this century differs from the last century in an important respect, that is, who can vote. All right, the share of the vote, the property qualifications for voting, they have been gradually removed. Majority rule has become to be more important, and I won't elaborate all of those things. Second, we looked at, or have looked at, some of the data for other countries over long periods of time. And the two countries in particular that I want to talk about very briefly are Sweden and Holland. Sweden, because it's a very useful country, they fought no wars during this period. And so they helped to distinguish between those explanations and say, well, the government grows in wartime, and then somehow the bureaucracy captures that particular gain, goes back, holds on to it, and that kind of story, I think, is a familiar story. What is true in Sweden is, of course, true in the United States, and it's true in Holland. That is, the government has been growing roughly twice as fast as the private sector in Sweden, and roughly twice as fast as the private sector in Holland over roughly comparable periods of time in those countries from 1870 to 1970, but long enough for us to be able to say that this is a phenomenon which is both exists in this country for quite a long period of time and exists in other countries. That is, the problem of trying to find out what is going on is not going to be limited to a search for devils among the presidents of the United States, or among Supreme Court justices, or among or particular events which have been passed here. It's quite widespread, ubiquitous in all Western countries in which there is political voting right and democratic and some kind of democratic procedure, and in which the market system operates. So that tells us something about the process which has been going on, and it helps to discriminate against other kinds of theories. It also, I believe, helps to discriminate, or we ought to be able to discard and throw into the ash can, what are a series of devil theories. That is, by a devil theory, I mean that we think that there is some group, the labor unions, the bureaucracy, the press, who push for power. We would think that a rational theory of this particular process, the political process, ought to emphasize that while it may be true that there are all of us, and I mean all of us, would like to increase both our wealth and our income and our power, that's what we certainly believe, and that if we have the opportunity to do that, we do. What needs to be explained is why, in a process which has been going on for more than 100 years and is quite widespread, no one ever learns that that's the result of the legislation that they propose, the legislation that they enact, of the congressman that they elect, that this process continuously goes on, and yet no group ever forms which says, we are the low-tax party, let's roll all this back. But it goes on faster at times, slower at times. Nevertheless, it continues. From that, what are, at their core, basically irrational approaches. That is, they believe, they rest on the proposition that somehow individuals who are being taxed, spent, losing, and who are being taxed or who are being regulated and who are losing their freedoms never wake up to the fact that this process is going on, has been going on, and that they don't organize a coalition or a group or simply don't go to the polling place and vote against programs of this kind. So we have developed or taken a somewhat different approach, what we call a taker theory. By a taker theory, I mean nothing more nor less than the kind of theory which we're all familiar with from simple principles of economics. Each individual acts in his own interest, believes that the market is out there, believes that the voting process is out there, and asks, what is the best that I can do for me, given that I have this resource called my vote that I can use to allocate expenditures to me? So we would expect to find that, by and large, the people who would be voting for redistribution, who would be voting for some kind of redistribution, would be those who would be down in the lower tail of the voting distribution. And those who people who would be complaining about high taxes, who would be voting against high taxes, who would be electing people who would be against high taxes, would be in the upper tail of the distribution. And somewhere in the middle would lie the median voter. That is, the man who would really act, if he knew who we were, as the dictator in the society, the one who's going to choose what the tax schedule is going to be that everyone is going to pay. And if he were rational, he would be able to make that choice for everybody in the society, and therefore he would govern how the political process is going to operate. Now, that process says, and it's long, and perhaps I will spare a lot of the details, but that process simply says that in the voting booth, each individual acts to maximize. There are more people, because of the way the distribution of income appears in the process, because of the way the votes are distributed, we have a lot of people to vote for redistribution and not very many people to vote against it, and the majority therefore rules, and the majority rules in such a way as to redistribute income to themselves. Now, the problem with that explanation, which has bothered me for a long period of time, is that it explains too much. That is, it isn't that it doesn't explain the process, it seems to me, very well. It explains much too much. Why don't the poor get together and simply confiscate all the wealth right away and redistribute it to themselves and end the whole game? And that's the more, for me, has been the much more difficult question to try to find a rational solution. And basically, the answer that we've come up with is, of course, is the simple answer that I think any market-oriented economist would recognize. Namely, there are incentives. If I tax you 100 for 100% of your income, you have no incentive to work. If you are a person above the median income, and we tax all of the income above the median, then of course you're just as well off if you earn the median income and stop. So we have to allow you to have some opportunity to increase your income above the median income. That is, we can't redistribute all of the income away from you, but we have to redistribute some of the income away from you to take as much as we can while still giving you an incentive to save, invest, and work. That's the process which limits the growth of government. That is, it's the process of incentives which operates to keep the poor from confiscating, or the median voter from setting a tax schedule which will confiscate all the wealth in society and cause it to be redistributed. Now, briefly then, why has the government grown? One, I will not give by any means all the explanation of that, but basically because of three reasons. One, because the franchise has been extended. The Voting Rights Act of 1964, the fact that we see a spurt in the number of programs is not accidental. We may, in fact, all be in favor of the Voting Rights Act of 1964, and we may be in favor of the extension of the franchise. But a consequence of the Voting Rights Act of 1964 is that we've enfranchised a larger number of voters in the lower tail of the income distribution who now vote for more redistribution. Second, because income has grown, and as income has grown, there is more opportunity for redistribution. And third, because the mean, and most important of all, because the mean income lies above the median, and there is income there to be taxed. And that's, so in my view, and perhaps oversimplifying a bit, if George McGovern had campaigned, had understood a little more statistics, he would have told the voters in California and elsewhere that I am going to redistribute income from people above the median to people below the median. He would have said, I'm going to redistribute income from people above the mean to people below the median. And then when they asked him, who are those people, he would have said, why, those people who are above $18,000, and that would have been a much smaller number of negative votes than if he, when he had to say those people above $12,000, people began to understand that redistributing income from above the median to below the median meant redistributing my income, and that was a very different game than the game that he thought he was playing. These are then some of the implications of this theory of rational behavior. And I will close by citing one additional implication, which I recently learned. I thought I knew something about taxation in the United States, but I really learned a lot by reading an article by Craig Roberts in Harper's, and I hope other people have read it in the March issue of Harper's, because it really fits very neatly with the explanation that I've just given. He asked the question, let's go out and compute the income tax and find out who is paying the income tax. And he found that above the median, 93% of the income tax is being paid by people above the median, 7% by people below the median. So if you believe this process, in which there is a rational process, in which people are going to the market, to the voting booth, are redistributing income to themselves, taxing people above the median in order to get income and redistribute to themselves, and you read Paul Craig Roberts and you say, well, they've come very close to doing what, in fact, under an optimal system, they ought to be willing to do. That is, to collect all the taxes and only taxes from people above the median, and to give only the benefits or principal benefits to people below the median. And I'm unhappy with that outcome, but pleased to see that it coincides with a rational view in which there are no devils other than the devil that we are ourselves, in which the issue is a cognitive issue which can be resolved, at least hopefully resolved, and understood in terms of a theory which is very similar to the kind of market-oriented theory that we use to explain how people behave in markets. And then finally, that if there is a way to solve the problem, it will necessarily, I believe, have to be based upon a correct analysis of why the problem arises. Thank you.